Well, we continue our look at the readings for Christmas Day with the Gospel from John 1, verses 1 through 14. A few introductory comments might get us thinking along the lines of the themes in the reading. Don Carson, in his commentary, describes the prologue as a foyer to the rest of the fourth Gospel. He says it simultaneously draws the reader in and introduces the major themes. This is a real challenge because there are several words here which offer very little trouble to the translator, but you could create a whole course on trying to explain what this word means in the context of John's writings. Think for a moment about the major sort of concept words that appear in these first 14 verses. We have life, light, witness, true, world, glory, truth. He doesn't mention grace. We'll talk about that later as really not a main theme word in John, but certainly it will be important for those of us preaching on this text. He says, supremely, the prologue summarizes how the Word, which was with God in the very beginning, came into the sphere of time, history, and tangibility. In other words, how the Son of God was sent into the world to become the Jesus of history. The rest of the book is nothing other than an expansion of this theme. Now, I like to contrast that with a statement from Kelly and Maloney in their book on experiencing God in the Gospel of John. They say, from one angle, the prologue is really not prologue at all. There's nothing for a word about it. It's a direct celebration of the Word, given from the realm beyond the beginning, middle, end of the various scripts that make up world history and human lives. The original and all-originating Word comes to make known the otherwise ineffable God. In this perspective, the Gospel narrative that follows is epilogue, afterword. It fleshes out the presence of the Word among us, as His unbroken communion with the Father draws into itself all who come to believe. I say, in one sense, the final verses of the Gospel can be paraphrased in the form of a question. Now that you've been through the story of the life and light coming into the world, does the prologue make sense? Okay, let's start right in. Probably anyone who has ever studied Greek for more than 10 minutes has looked at John 1, verse 1 in Greek, and we'll review some of the problems without giving all the detailed grammatical discussion here. En arche ein ha logos. The beginning, or here arche is used in a somewhat absolute sense. In the phrase en arche, we can treat it as definite. Remember that in prepositional phrases, the definite article is often dropped in Greek. So not just a beginning, but the beginning was the Word. Kai ha logos en pros ton theon. And the Word was with God, is the way we traditionally translate it, by near God. Here I think it's important to see that this pros is not sort of just giving the location of Jesus, but it's really describing a relationship, and a relationship that's very intimate. Pros suggests being face to face with someone, and you can again imagine all that's suggested when someone can stand face to face with God. This is one of those matters that's very important culturally when you're speaking with someone. How do you look at them or not look at them? And it often reminds me of how confused I was as a child when my mother was scolding me. And if I looked down at my feet, she would say, "Look at me when I'm talking to you." If I looked at her, she would say, "Don't look at me like that." Are you showing disrespect by looking, or are you showing that you're not paying attention by not looking? But here the Word was in such an intimate communion with God that it was prostantheon, face-to-face with God. And how is that possible? that one can look at God and not die, not be overwhelmed by His glory and majesty, because kai theos ein ha logos. Because, and the Word was God. Now, again, anyone who's taken much Greek has rehearsed the arguments here about how do you determine which is the subject and which is the predicate. That's the easier of two big questions regarding this last clause. Normally, when you have a nominative noun with a verb like to be and then a nominative predicate, the subject noun will have the article and the predicate will not, and that's why this gets translated the Word was God rather than God was the Word, which would be the Greek word order. The sort of more complicated question is really, what's the force of the os here? Should we regard it as definite or indefinite? I had a Jehovah's Witness tell me once that there's no article there, so we have to translate it. The Word was a God, small g, which means simply He was sort of like God. There's a very thorough discussion of this in an article by Philip Harner that appeared in the Journal of Biblical Literature back in 73. And his argument, and I think it's a good one, is that theos here should be regarded as qualitative. His summary paragraph says it shows how difficult it is to catch this idea in English. Some say the Word was God, the one we're more familiar with. New English has what God was, the Word was. But all of these are at least vulnerable to the confusion that we're equating two persons of the Trinity, or we're saying the Word is only like God. His understanding is that the sort of the thought being expressed here is that the Logos has the same nature of Theos as Theos does. That is, both Logos and Theos are Theos, in that sense, God. So this is a difficult thing to try to draw out in Venn diagrams. It's not that Logos is a subset of Theos or vice versa, but these are Logos participates fully in the nature of God, even as the person we usually address as God does himself. Okay, I think I probably just made that several times more confusing than it was to you 10 minutes ago. Continuing then with verse 2, Houtos ein, NRK proston theon. Okay, so again, sort of recapping what has just been said, this one was in the beginning, proston theon, with God, face to face with God. Panta di autu egenita. Panta here, in the neuter, everything through him, egenita, came into being. And you notice the contrast between a me when we're talking about the Logos and the imperfect tense. He was in this condition, sort of a continual way of talking about his state of being, and now you have the verb become, the change of condition kind of verb, and the aorist tense. So all things came into being, a specific so action, and that happened diautu, through him, through this word. Kai choris autu egenita uda hin. Udehin. At the end of verse 3, you have some disagreements on exactly where the break in thought occurs. Nestle all in 27 now has a period after hen and connects the ha gegonin with what follows in verse 4. If you look up hen in bedag, you'll see they had sort of recommend the same reading on the basis that udeh hen often occurs at the end of a sentence or clause. So we'll translate it that way, although ultimately the difference in meaning is not all that great. So all things came into being through him, kai choris autu, and apart from him, we could translate this impersonally, there came into being not even one. So nothing came into being apart from him. Then talking about what did come into being, ha gegonin en auto, what did come into being through him, in him, zoe ein, was life, kai he zoe ein tafos ton anthropon. And the life, that is this life that's just been mentioned, was the light of human beings. Okay, so we've gone from all creation now to focusing on mankind in particular. Kai tafos ente skotia phine, and the light shines, present tense phine, in the darkness. Kai he skotia auta u kat elaben. Kat elaben is the aorist from kata lambano. It's a challenge to the English translator because it really suggests two ideas. Bedag here takes it in the sense of seizing with hostile intent. They say overtaking in that sense, sort of conquering something. But it can also be used in the sense of really comprehending, grasping something completely, in that sense having control over it. The way we might say he has good control over his field of study. One translation I've always liked for this passage that I think captures both ideas in English is the New English Bible translation. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has never mastered it. So you get both the ideas of control and comprehension. And of course, in this verse, then we've had introduced one of the great sort of thematic symbols of John's gospel, the light and darkness contrast. Okay, continuing with verse 6, then, Egeneta anthropos, there was a human. Here, we're clearly introducing a new character, this logos. Is God, not anthropos. And so now we're talking about someone other than the Logos. Apelstamenos para theou. From apostello, being having been sent, aorist participle. From God, para, here with the genitive. Common way of saying sent out from someone's presence, their authority. Onoma auto Ioannis, and the name to him was John. That's a common way in the New Testament of identifying a person by name, using the dative then of either possession or respect here. Translated, his name was John. Houtos Aelthen, this one now, this John, Aelthen Ace Martyrion, he came to witness, or as, in order to give testimony, with Ace here expressing the purpose of the coming, we might say, or he came for witness, or for testimony, Hina Martyrese Peri Tu Photos. Here the Hina explains what exactly that witness was to be. He came for witness, namely that he might witness concerning the light. So hina there with the typical aorist subjunctive, but not specifically giving purpose, but explaining the purpose expressed in the Ace Martyrion. Hina pantes pistiusosin, and now you have hina in its more purpose, its more final sense. in order that all those pistousosin who are believing or that is have come to believe, in order that all might believe through him. The diao tu, at first glance, might seem like it's believing in Jesus. I mean, that's what we would expect. But with the dia, it seems better to take it as believing through John, that is, through this witness that he was sent by God to bring. Then to clarify, again, the difference between this one and the logos, uk ein ekenos tafos. So not was that one, that is John, the light, but in order to al hina martirese peri tu photos. Again, something has dropped out. The verb to come is the most, the simplest way to fill in the gap here. But he came in order that he might testify concerning the light. We'll see it later in chapter 1 that John piles up forms of martireo in that family of words in describing John, so that there's no mistake that John's role is one of a witness of giving testimony. Okay, then verse 9, ein ta phos ta alethinon. This was the light, the true one. Here you see that second attributive position with the article being repeated. So this was the true light, or he was the true light, that is the logos, who photidze, who enlightens panta anthropon, every man. This true light was then coming into the world. Some have asked whether erchomenon eston kosmon couldn't refer to man. There was an expression of simply describing humanity as those who came into the world. But that doesn't seem to be either John's style or to really make much sense here. So the point is that this light is coming into the world. Okay, and then ten ento cosmo ein, kai ha cosmos diao tu egeneta. So again, with this logos, the he as the subject, he was in the world, the cosmos, and the world was through him. Here, egeneta really has the force of created or brought into being. It became through him. Kai ha cosmos auton uk egno, and the world did not know him. This will be one of the main themes of John. It's really a main theme of all the Gospels, the idea of recognition. Who can see Jesus for who he truly is? The world was in one sense his. He had made it, and the next verse emphasizes that. And yet when he comes to the world, even though he comes as light, the world doesn't know him. Ace ta idia eilthin, he came to his own. Here, ta idia neuter, in the sense of his home, the things, the world he had created. And perhaps even more specifically, the people God had chosen, the Israel and their heritage as God's covenant people. And continuing, kai hoi idioi, and the peculiar ones, that is, those who were his own, now masculine, indicating people, here probably typically in the sense of relatives. That is, your people, in the way we even sometimes still use it. Par elabon, did not receive him or welcome him. So it's interesting to, if you just glance down, we'll move on and get there eventually. So he is from God, but they won't take him in, that is, accept him for who he truly is, who he announces himself to be. Hazoide, but as many as, and here hazoi is a correlative, but it doesn't always have a second word that actually completes the equation. So here you simply have hazoi being paired up with autois, where as many as did receive him, here the simple lambano in the aorist, edoken autois, to those he gave exousion technatha ou genesthai. He gave the capability, the power. The idea really is that he is the one who can make them become technatha ou. Not that he gives them the choice or declares that you have this right, attached to you and the others don't. But through who he is, he makes it possible for this to happen. So we're really connected back with this ginamai of creation. Now there is a new kind of creation that they are technatha ou, children of God. John does not use the term son, huios, for humans. And so there's something of a distinction made between believers as children of God and Jesus then as the unique Son of God. But of course that's not true throughout the New Testament, and we need to look at the distinction and again define it in biblical terms, neither making too little of it or too much of it. Tois pistou ousen, here again defining who these autois, who these hazoi are. These are the ones who are believing in eis ta anima autu, in his name. And here to believe in his name is really to believe that his name is an accurate expression of who he is, that he rightly has this name. And the name will be very important in John, not just the name Jesus, or even here the title Logos, but as Jesus will claim the divine I am for himself, and so believing that he is the one who can say I am. 13. Hoi uk ex haimaton ude ek thelematos sarkos ude ek thelematos andras al ek the u egenethezon. Again, there has been some discussion about the hoi. Is it, should it be plural or singular? That is verse 13 describing the believers, or is it really describing the autu, the him? There is very little manuscript evidence to support the singular reading, and Nestle, Alland, and most commentators have followed then the plural, so that this is a description of those believers who are not of the bloods. Notice it's plural, genitive. Here, probably in the sense of just physical descent, nor of the will of the flesh, of flesh, thelematos. Here can be translated as desire, and many take this of sexual desire, but not condemning it in as immoral or sinful. But also not of the will of andros, a male. So many would take this to say the origin of the people we're talking about, these believers, these technatha ou, can't be explained by any of the usual human processes of procreation, whether it's through pregnancy and birth, whether it's through sexual desire, whether it's through the will of a man to have an heir. None of those explain the origins of the technatha ou. Allah, rather, all of those are wrong answers, but they are ek the ou, egenathazon. They are begotten of God. And genao here in the aorist passive can be translated as birth, but it is often used for the role of the male part, and the male is often introduced with ek. So here God is really taking the role of the father here, not the mother. I don't know if we have a better contemporary word. I guess we could say simply, they were fathered by God, or begotten of God. Okay, and then verse 14, we'll stop there with this shorter option for the gospel, just because of our time constraints here. Kai halagos sarx egeneta, kai eskenosen en hemin. In this passage, we have sort of one incredible statement after another, but this one should certainly be included on that list. We've made the contrast between the Word who was and always was, and men and individuals who become things through the agency of the Word, and now we have Logos with Egeneta, the Word becomes flesh. Kai eskenos en hemin, and dwelt among us. I'm sure most listeners are familiar with the connection between the dwelling idea and actually living in a tent. I think it was the NASB translated it as tabernacled among us, and a very likely allusion back to God's presence in Israel in the tabernacle, but now in a much deeper way and even in a more concrete way, this word becomes flesh, becomes human. The language here avoids saying the word became a man, as if he's no longer Logos, but turns into a new condition, and then allows for the later sort of theological language of assuming flesh, taking flesh into himself. So he becomes what humans are, but we can still refer to him as ha logos. Kai theosametha tein doxon autu, and we beheld his glory, doxon hos monogenus para patros. Glory as of the only one from the Father. We don't have time to rehearse all the elements of the debate about only versus only begotten, but the sort of the simple etymology is this is monos and genos, so genos here as genus, kind, or type, which ultimately goes back to the idea of birth and even becoming, but it more directly is connected with the only member of a certain type or genus of things. So here it's the uniqueness of the Son that's being pointed out. And of course the Father-Son relationship is never in the background. He's the only one from the Father. And then the pleres charitas kai aletheos. Who does pleres modify? Patros is genitive, monogenus is genitive, autu is genitive, pleres is nominative. You would really have to go clear back to logos to find a nominative masculine singular. Brown and some of the grammars like Blas de Brunner point out that often pleres was treated as indeclinable, so it didn't necessarily take on the case of its own clause. And that seems to be what's happening here. And then whether it's logos or monogenus doesn't really matter since those are the same person. But this one is full of charitas kai aletheos, grace and truth. And here, especially since this is the gospel for Christmas Day, it's important to remember that caritas, as Bedeg says, is not always clearly distinguished from kara, joy. And I think there's a danger here that we're going to get caught up in very profound theological reflection and forget that this should be a celebration filled with joy. And the charis idea really is this is it's when a person takes delight in something, you show this favor, you do things freely for that person. And then aletheos as the true, the real. Brown translates this as enduring love, combining the two ideas really into one concept, thinking back to Old Testament pairings of God's chesed and his emet. This one comes. He comes as light, not although this happens that the light exposes sin, but that's not the purpose of his coming, not to condemn, but to bring grace and to bring a true revelation of the Father. John, in this passage, I think, removes any last shred of confidence that we have that we can distinguish somehow between translation, interpretation, and contemplation, because we're immediately drawn in, and you really want to take weeks to read through this passage, pausing after every phrase and thinking about what exactly John is really saying for us. There's so many sermon themes that it seems almost irresponsible on my part to suggest any. But I was thinking one way you might consider this is looking at some of the interesting pairings that now become one in this person. Especially the idea of logos and sarx, and then of grace and truth, which some people would see as opposites. Right? You're gracious when you don't say the truth. So grace sort of overlooks things. But here, grace and truth now become one in this person. Word and flesh, the one who is God becomes flesh. The pairings that we see now brought together are certainly worthy of joyful reflection and contemplation on Christmas Day. We will stop here. Thank you, and pray God's blessings on your Christmas worship and proclamation.